Hello and welcome to another edition of Editing Aloud. I hope the lights don't go out while we're talking. These are dark days indeed, and we're very lucky to have on this panel and to have around us in our lives generally Hilary Joffe, because not only has she worked at Business Day for a long time, but she's also worked at Eskom. So she knows people there, and she knows how painful it must be for them to be in this situation, and the painful for the country. Because Hilary, you've written about the economy extensively for many years. This is hurting South Africa unbelievably.
It would have to. Sustained load shedding is really going to do huge economic damage and damage confidence, which the president had been working so hard to rebuild over the past year. I think we don't know yet how long it's going to be, but there's clearly no quick fix solution. And that was the tenor of yesterday's press conference by the Department of Public Enterprise. And I think that, you know, we already had pretty modest growth expectations for this year. Yeah. The Treasury's forecasting 1.5%.
That's not going to happen.
I'm not sure we're going to make it.
Yeah. So I watched a bit of that press conference yesterday. It was Pravin Gordhan was there, CEO of Eskom was there, Jabu Mabuza, the chairman, was there. What did you think of how well or how not well they did?
I felt there was a lack of preparation, and I wasn't sure what the message was or the narrative, and there was very little new information. That is a worry. I think perhaps they're not working with the Eskom communications people internally, who have a lot of experience in these sorts of briefings.
So not working with?
The Eskom communications people internally, who have quite a lot of experience in these sorts of briefings. But I think a lot of people, including people in the market, were struck by how little was actually said. It took a very long time to say very little, and educational stuff about how does the boiler work, which certainly some of the people in that press conference know very well, and what they want to know is what's going on and what are you going to do about it.
And if there is a hole in a tube in a boiler, then what they said, I presume, is true, right? So you cool it down, you get into the mass of tubing that is inside these things. It can be 100 meters high, some of these boilers. What is there to do other than weld it closed again?
Look, Peter, I think one's got to be very wary of people trying to over-technicalize this problem. Mm. I mean, we know these power stations are clapped out, the old ones. Yeah. We know the new ones are not performing the way they were supposed to because the process of building there was really not ideal. We know that. The point is, are there people there? Is there management and leadership which can nurse these power stations through it? Because it's not like any of these problems are new. They are worse, but they are not new. And in the past, I think there have been more resources in terms of institutional memory, which I'm very worried has got very lost because so many people have left, institutional memory and skills and experience. And my fear is that that kind of competence to nurse the system through is just not there to the same extent anymore because of the kind of huge damage that capture and corruption have done to Eskom and the huge damage of, in fact, the political interference of the past few years. So I think it's a management problem and it's not a purely technical problem. Okay. And I think looking at boiler tube leaks, which, I mean, you'll remember 2008, we also heard all about the boiler tube leak, is not really telling us anything.
Yeah. What would management have to do? What would the right management be doing now?
First of all, they'd be marshalling resources. Yeah. Second of all, they'd be making sure whatever resources they need. I mean, if there's no diesel, it's because you didn't plan for this much diesel. It's not just because there's money.
Yeah. Mm. And it comes by ship because we can't store it, right?
So it needs to be refined and the refineries need to provide for it. Yeah. You need to kind of get down there and sort out the diesel. Yeah. If the maintenance is not being done properly, then somebody needs to get onto why it's not being done properly. One of the Eskom insiders, I must say, put it this way. He said, Eskom is being run by procurement and human resources. In other words, the sort of compliance stuff is now so overwhelming the kind of
engineering
operation, not just the engineering, just the kind of need to fix things because of perhaps fears of corruption now, that they sort of strangled. And one of the examples, one of the new things that I did discover, it's technical in a way, there was a contract to predict when the boiler tube leaks would happen, which Eskom had long had in place. This was either cancelled or expired 18 months ago. It has not been renewed. So in other words, that predictive kind of maintenance that used to be in place, that data analysis that they used to use, is no longer there, and that contract has not yet been renewed.
Good grief, you know. I mean, so in the middle of all of this, Lucanio, we find even in the state sector more madness in the paper this, in Business Day this morning. An amazing story from Carol Payton, and it's ESCOM related as well, Hilary. I don't know whether you read it. That Optimum, which is the Gupta coal mine supplying Hendrina, one of the biggest power, the biggest power station in the whole fleet, that somebody's made a bid to buy it for, out of business rescue, and the somebody is a state-owned mining company that didn't have permission from the Treasury to do it, didn't have permission from the Minister of Energy to do it, and there's this deal being done between the business rescue people and something called AEMFC, which basically
out of going to be the state mining company.
Basically related to the Central Energy Fund. These are the people who sold our petrol stocks. How does that happen?
I mean, this is really a fascinating story, Peter. And then the funny thing as well, this wasn't really done in secret. All you have to do is just Google it. And the thing was announced in February out there, like it's in the open. And like, you know, it sort of just talks about a lack of control, right?
Yeah.
Like, did nobody, when they saw this press release or this news article, say, like, oh, how did they do this? Where did they get the permission from?
Has there been a news article about it?
Yeah.
Where did it appear?
It appeared all over the place. All you have to do is Google the name, and you'll see, like, news articles in February about them being appointed as the preferred
partner. So why did we not put up our ears and say, hang on a second, this is...
But I suppose at the time, like, I mean, that's why it's a breaking story. Yeah. But at the time, we didn't actually know that these rules were broken or that they didn't actually got the necessary permission from, from. I mean, it's just extraordinary, right? Like, it's not something you would think to ask because you would think like.
Yeah, I have to say, I mean, the business rescue at there are two coal mines that Gupta's own that supplied. One supplies Kumati, I think it is, and there's Kumati and Hendrina. Optimum supplies Hendrina. It's an Afrikaans name that I can't remember at the moment. Supplies Kamati, and that business risk—it's a dirty business, you know, because there's all sorts of stuff moving out of those coal mines all the time. And it moves out at night, you know, slurry, and this sort of thing. And nobody knows, you know. Surely the business rescue people are doing these kind of deals. How can they be trusted to do a decent job?
Look, I sympathise with. The public enterprise minister Praveen Gordhan, there is just so much to clean up. It must be feel overwhelming. But I continue to think that apart from the cleanup, I mean, of course one needs to obsess about the cleanup because it keeps coming out in so many different ways. But putting that on one side, what is needed is to put in strong executives at Eskom. Let them do what they need to do and don't sort of cripple them with a bunch of requirements or political interference, you know, and let them turn the place around because it's not unfixable.
It is fixable. I mean, the whole idea that I think Praveen has, I mean, we've always, I mean, he's great fight was a Zuma fight and we applaud him for that. I think with regards to now where he's sitting when it comes to Eskom, he's freezing that company. Nothing is happening in the company because of this political intervention within Eskom. If the CEO, Phakamani, has got no strength within the organization, the board itself, they can't actually do the job of sweating the assets, which is the focus, what should be. All this talk about, yesterday he mentioned 3,000 employees. I just imagine myself as an Eskom employee. Would I be willing to do anything? Would I be willing to sign any document or procure anything right now at Eskom, knowing that there's this cloud here and there's this all-powerful minister, he's done a great job, right? He's one of our, I'll put it out there, one of our heroes. But with regards to Eskom, I think it's time now that DP and Praveen steps aside and these issues of
optimism. Have they got the right management in there?
Clearly, he has got no faith in the board, right? So maybe, and it's his board.
Or the chief executive.
So changes should be made there and he should step back. And actually, I mean, the frustrating thing about Eskom and our problems are all these problems, we knew about them in 2013, all the solutions and the governance of these SOEs, we have them. The government themselves have put them down, but no one is enacting them. And as much as Malusi was terrible for DP, I would say Praveen's intervention now is just as bad. Although he's a good guy, and we know there's a rot in Eskom, but his work now is actually crippling Eskom. Eskom needs to focus on the operations, all the coal power stations.
But he needs to find, you know, I have to say, I mean, you know, Brian Molef has been accused of a lot of things, but he was a good leader in Eskom. People liked him, people seem to respond to him. Mm. The fact that he was involved in all sorts of nefarious things is poor, but a good leadership. Yeah, good leadership matters.
Yes, and great executives who are actually engineers, as she said, yeah. who actually know how these things tick and work. Yeah. Right now,
how many engineers are there on the board?
With experience, there's none, right? Right now, there's
Not just a question of engineers. Mm. There are non-engineers who know how to run engineering organizations. Mm. Some of the people who run big mining companies in South Africa are not engineers. They're CAs or whatever they are.
Yeah.
It's there are people with experience in running very large. Operating technical organizations. They don't have to be engineers as such, but they need, as Ron says, I totally agree. I mean, you need, if you don't like the executives or the board and you don't trust them, put in people who can do the job, who you do trust, and then trust them to do it.
Is it also like a point, you know, when they came in, obviously, like when the new board, it was all already about the financing, right? About trying to get them back into the markets because nobody was lending to Eskom at the time.
Yeah.
Maybe like their focus ended up too much really being about
finance
and not really about how to run the place. Yeah. So all these things that Ron is talking about, they were basically neglected because.
And listen, at the end of next week, what happens? Moody's, what does Moody's do at the end of next week? Does it adjust its outlook or does it grade us?
There is a bit of a confusion about that because there's an assumption to some people that you have to change the outlook before you actually...
Technically, you don't.
But apparently, so we cleared it up with them last week. Yeah. You don't actually have to, even though it's very unusual for them to just go straight from... not changing the outlook and go straight to like downgrading you.
Yeah.
But you shouldn't be ruling it out.
Yeah.
Yeah. The trouble is if they don't anticipate, it makes them look like they've missed the ball. Okay. Their eyes been off the ball. So they usually try and message it in advance, but it's perfectly possible they might not do that.
So what do you think they'll do? I mean, South Africa now is unable to supply power 24/7, which is a shocking state of affairs to be in. There seems to be no quick fix. We will, you know, their announcement may take place in the dark.
We might even vote in the dark.
So, so how possibly could Moody's not downgrade us, Hillary?
They look at our ability to pay.
Mm.
That's really all credit agencies do. Are we credit worthy? What is our ability to repay our debts? And so far, every time they've come to the brink, because they've put us on review for a downgrade twice now and pulled back.
Mm.
So they've got to be quite careful this time because they can't cry wolf again.
Mm.
So if they put us on, they could put us on negative outlook, which I think is extremely likely.
Yeah.
They're looking at the fiscal figures. They're looking at the debt ratios and at South Africa's ability to repay. The budget itself, you'll recall, was pretty grim, the numbers.
Yeah.
And now, in addition to that, we've got a growth story which may not even be as modestly good as the budget anticipated.
So next Friday is going to be a bad news day one way or the other.
I would imagine the most likely is a negative outlook. Okay.
Another old friend of the House, as it were, a former colleague of ours on both, certainly on the Financial Mail, I'm not sure whether he ever worked for Business Day, Duncan MacLeod, you know, he writes about technology and he's set up his own technology media business, but he's also been active politically lately and he started his own party called, and not to be confused with the South African Communist Party, but the ZACP, the Capitalist Party of South Africa. Duncan, who's on the phone, you're going to field 10 candidates in the May 8th election on a pro-free market, individual liberty ticket. Duncan, welcome to the show. And why are you moving into the DA space like this?
Peter, thanks for having me. I'm a big fan of the show. So it's a privilege to be on. We think the DA has moved somewhat to the left in recent years. In some respects, it's been a bit like an ANC light. So I think they've opened up a gap in the market, and I think there's a space for this. You know, millions of South Africans are capitalists, probably without even knowing it. The taxi driver is a capitalist.
Absolutely.
The barber shop owner is a capitalist, and we're the party for those people, and we hope to appeal to them.
Yeah. And sort of what sort of policy positions do you think, you know, you don't have much time and you probably don't have much resources. What sort of policy positions can you take that would be attractive to somebody who's driving a taxi or who's trying to sell, you know, fruit on the streets of Johannesburg? How can you help them? Because that's what they are. They're informal traders, but they are in a market and we need to do our best to make sure that market is free and fair.
Absolutely, and I highly encourage anyone listening to the show or watching the show to visit our website, capitalist.org.za, where we set out all of our plans and some key interventions we intend to promote in Parliament once we are elected, to make some real and meaningful changes immediately. We also set out our 10 principles, which are focused around, as you said, liberty, free markets, and individual rights before group rights.
Yeah.
And I think that capitalism in many respects in South Africa has become a bit of a dirty word, and it needn't be. Capitalism has lifted billions of people out of poverty in the last 50 years, and it can have the same impact in South Africa if we allow business to flourish and we get the government out of people's lives.
I'm going to ask some of my colleagues to grill you as well, Ron. I mean, one question for Duncan, what would it be?
It would definitely be the question of transformation and land. What are your thoughts with regards to those two? Well, those are big fracture in the DA. So what are your views on BEE and taking it forward and transformation of the country?
Our view on black economic empowerment and affirmative action is very clear. We take a position of equality and that individual rights take supremacy to group rights. And our position, I'm quoting from our website here, affirmative action undermines meritocracy. Historical discrimination against certain groups does not justify present discrimination against other groups.
Lukanya?
I suppose you don't go into a race if you think you're going to lose. So what are your ambitions in terms of how many seats are you aiming for?
Well, we've got 10 candidates, and we're hoping to get all 10 into Parliament. So that's our plan.
Duncan, if you get all 10 into Parliament, I will personally buy you the most expensive case of champagne I can lay my hands on. Hillary, what do you think?
What is your strategy to grow the economy, Duncan?
Yeah, come on.
Well, we're going to get the government out of the economy. We're going to fix Eskom, and we're going to do that by breaking it up, selling off the bits, and most importantly, probably, introducing competition at every level of the electricity system.
Yeah.
And we're going to do that in every sector. We don't think the government should be running businesses, and we're going to privatize and sell off SOEs, introducing competition at the same time, and get the economy working again. I think it's been shown that the government cannot run companies and it needs to get out.
Duncan, you need about between 35 and 50,000 votes to get a seat in Parliament.
Yes.
You probably could if you were running an imaginative campaign. And we'll see how well you do. You've got to get out into the streets and knock on doors and pamphleteer and all that sort of thing. What would you do if you were in a position, say, after the election in, say, Gauteng, and you were able to decide whether the EFF or the DA or the ANC became the next provincial government? Would you go into coalition with any one of those?
Well, we unfortunately won't be in that position because we're not contesting the provincial ballots. We're only contesting at the national level.
Well, there you go. All right. Well, I'll let you offer that answer. Listen, lots of good luck. Have a lot of fun and make a lot of noise. And we'll watch you. We'll watch you carefully.
It's great fun. Thanks very much,
Peter. Okay. Take care, Duncan. Thanks very much. A panel in the lead in the Financial Mail today. Unfortunately, we don't have either the editor or the deputy editor with us. But what we have is a story about what Steinhoff, as Steinhoff's edited version, I presume, of the PwC report into the collapse of Steinhoff, right? And as I understand it, in Parliament, the chairman of Steinhoff, Heather Son, was forced to say who these senior executives were, and she named Marcus Huster and a whole lot of other people. Is there anything in here that you've seen? Does this take the story any further? I mean, has PwC produced anything prosecutable?
Well, I mean, the numbers, I mean, you're saying like it's a summary, but
I'm saying, yeah, but I mean, the numbers what I'm are asking bigger, is can Marcus Huster be prosecuted on the basis in South Africa for what PwC has discovered, do you think?
I mean, it says here that they had fictitious deals of up to 100 billion rands.
Yeah.
I mean, if that's not procedurable.
but they might not all have taken place here.
I was was wondering actually about the possibility of a prosecution, the likely prospect of a prosecution by the German authorities. And you remember that it was the German tax authorities
that first raised the red flag. Yeah.
And surely a lot of this was offshore structures. Yeah. And in Europe, this sounds
But it all it will do is take one deal, one cocky little deal in this country. And we can have them in jail here rather than relaxing, you know, in a German prison in Bonn or on the banks of the Rhine.
Surely we want him here. Corruption to chase. Almost, perhaps we should sort of. But it's an important.
You know, this is white collar corruption. Yep. This is white collar crime, and it's so important that it gets nailed.
Yes, nailed here. Yeah. I mean, this will be one of the big tests for our new NPA. I think. There's lots of stuff in that. I mean, it's 11 pages of, I think it's a 15,000 page document, and hopefully that the NPA or our departments get a chance to look at it. But I think this is, I mean, there's enough in there to finally nail someone. And I agree with you, a big name, we need like a Juste candidate. We're always seeking the Zuma eventuality about Zuma going to court. But this is an opportunity.
I think this is a big opportunity. I mean, you know, you've got Marcello Cocco. Yes. I mean, that's like so obvious.
Yes.
Primal effort, not necessarily for ESCOM, but lots of stuff at Transnet. They've got to be, you know, if you were planning, and of course this is what you can't do, but if you wanted to make a big deal before an election, I'd put put handcuffs on some of these people, even if it's just for a few hours. You know, arrest them, charge them, they can go to court. I mean, later.
What's fascinating about this? You always talk about the NPA, about how like it's been destroyed and it's like less capacity. Yeah. But this story actually broke in Europe. But it doesn't look like anything actually that's happened in Europe in these 2 years either. I mean, I don't know, have you heard anything coming from the German prosecutors?
No.
I mean, I found that really quite strange.
No. Look, I mean, I think all of these legal agencies are slow. I mean, if you read the books on Juste, both two of them, right? Rob Rose and, oh my dear, I've forgotten who the other one was, but they both make the point that stuff happened here too. You know, all it requires is some investigation. I mean, Juste got off it was a civil case brought by SARS at the time. And he was found guilty and then not guilty by the Court of Appeals, which I think should look at its work again in the light of what we now know to be true. It's an absolutely amazing story. And it just happens to be today, I think, that you were reporting yesterday that Ramaphosa would today sign into law the creation at the NPA of this investigating director.
I think they were hoping to do that before Parliament closes. So
which is today.
So hopefully that will be done.
Yeah.
I mean, I'm not sure what the technicalities, what happens if he doesn't.
I don't
do
think
it.
Something you have to vote on or anything like that. I think it's just to be deposited
and
can be appointed. But Ron, whoever gets this job is going to have a field day.
Well, on this,
on everything.
On everything. I mean, it's an open season. And the one thing before Ramaphosa came into power, which I must applaud him for, like there was always a talk, his camp was saying, there's all these cases and we're going to go after everything as soon as if he wins in NASDAQ and so on, and we'll strike. And I think ahead of election, this is the time, man. This provides some ammunition. Can you imagine just Marcus Juste and Hermanus, like a whole raid on him? That would be excellent for him. Just give impetus.
Of course, but what can't happen is that you can't have that instruction be a political one.
Yeah, it cannot be. It must just happen.
And this has got to work.
Yes.
This has got to work with Shamila Batohi, the new head of the NPA, doing what she promised to do when she got the job, which was going catch these people.
Which he's been excellent at, right? Almost letting all these institutions get mend their ways and almost be less, it's not like a political decision.
Yeah.
And that must play its role here. In the same way, we want to do the same with ESCOM. Just let things happen divorce yourself from it. He's put the institutions in place and hopefully it would be a great thing to have.
Hilary, we've got less than 2 minutes left. Just to come back to ESCOM because people are worried about it, aren't they? You were worried earlier on about whether there were enough people there who knew how to fix these things. Is it possible to jump over? And you could hear Jabu Mabuza trying to say that in a way yesterday, to actually short circuit the processes and the procurement and all of that nonsense that happens in companies, and just you know, go out and find somebody in the States or wherever in Russia and just pay them an absolute fortune to come and fix six units at that keep tripping or whatever it might be. I mean, and bugger Eskom and their management and their processes.
I'm not sure one can and should bring in foreign experts, but yeah. I think there are lots of South Africans with lots of experience who are now outside the country.
But they may have jobs that they can't just walk away from.
They may, but they may be willing to come back under the right leadership and with the right resources and the right political support.
National service. So, but when there's talk about, like, Brian Dalmer sits there with Patrice Motsepe working his energy thing. If Motsepe can give us Brian Dalmer for 2 years on and, like, ensure he has a job after these 2 years kind of thing. Putting back in there, there's Paul O'Flaherty. There's
could
other
Brian,
people.
Could Brian Dalmer fix this?
He fixed 2008 and he didn't need a committee. He got on top of it in a few days.
So he's sitting there.
He's sitting there. In energy. Give him national service.
They're all doing, the whole of Eskom, ex-Eskom people are doing renewables.
Renewables. They're there. They're lurking around. So they're around.
Okay. Yeah. So there we go. There's a solution. Patrice Motsepe, please give us Brian Dalmer to run Eskom for 2 years. Thank you very much for being with us. We hope we'll see you this time again next week.